Hello, welcome to Science Weekly. I'm Alok Char. On this week's podcast...
Come girl! Come girl!
That was the Indiana Jones of conservation calling to some wild elephants. Our own David Adam went to South Africa to meet the adventurous Lawrence Anthony, a man credited with saving the Baghdad Zoo whilst war raged around him. Plus,
I have a hunch that they're all around us. They could be under our noses or even in our noses.
Physicist Paul Davis there alerting the scientific community to the fact that nobody's looking for alien life here on Earth and that it could be all around us. Plus, why trees are getting bigger, melting ice, and a rap from NASA. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome to all our listeners. With us in the pod today, David Adam, our environment correspondent. Hello, David.
Hello.
And James Randerson. Not sure what he does anymore, but he's certainly here. Hello, James.
Hello.
One day you can explain what you do. Now, at this point, we usually introduce a guest, but this week, David is the guest. No, we're not being lazy. He's been away to South Africa to meet a man who we like to call the Indiana Jones of conservation. Lawrence Anthony is an all-round animal action man. He went to Baghdad to rescue zoo animals in the teeth of the American invasion. He's the only outsider to talk to murderous African rebels about rhinos. And he lives with a herd of delinquent elephants. David, you spent a week in the African bush with this guy. Tell us what his story of the Baghdad invasions. I mean, take us through what he did.
Well, it's extraordinary. He lives on a reserve in South Africa. And he was watching the shock and awe bombardment of Baghdad that I think we all watched on television back in 2003. And he said that he grew up in Africa, but he was always very aware of stories in the Second World War, particularly of animals in zoos being killed in Berlin when the Allies bombed and took Berlin. Thousands of animals died in Berlin. He said it happened in Afghanistan, it happened in Kosovo. And so he got on the phone, and he's reasonably well connected politically in South Africa, and he managed to talk to people in the US and Britain who were at a reasonable high level and said to them, you know, there's hundreds of animals in the Baghdad Zoo. It's the finest zoo in the Middle East. Hundreds and hundreds of exotic species, you know, directly in the line of fire. What are you doing about all these animals? And he got no response, or people said, we're not doing anything about it. So he decided that he would do something about it. And literally, he flew to Kuwait with his own money and talked his way into Iraq.
And so when he got there, did he just walk in and clutch a couple of lines under his arms and walk out again? I'm sure
bit more complicated, but not a lot, actually. I mean, he turned up in Kuwait and he had various paperwork from various people, but the Americans wouldn't let him in. And this is literally days after they started their invasion. There are tanks going in as he's in Kuwait. And he said the Americans wouldn't let him in, and that was a bit of an issue. And then he said he realised that it wasn't the American border, it was the Kuwaiti border. So he went to the Kuwaiti authorities, and they said, yeah, sure, you can go in. So he
you lunatic.
Yeah.
So, if you want.
So he got a hire car. He went in with, there was a couple of Kuwaiti guys who worked at Kuwait Zoo who knew people in Baghdad they hadn't seen for ages, wanted to see them. They pitched up at the border with all the American military convoys with a car full of veterinary supplies. And the US soldier at the border just couldn't believe his eyes. So these three guys, everyone else was trying to get out. There were queues of people trying to get out across the border in the other direction. And these three guys wanted to get in. And he said to them, you do know there's a war on, don't you?
The piece you wrote for the Observer magazine yesterday, you described the fact that he's driving through all these places in 2003, and it was a bomb site. That's not even a metaphor. And so when he wandered in, your piece starts with the fact that he didn't know he's being tracked by a lion until he sort of saw it. What was that about?
There's these palaces all over Baghdad, and there's this one that was owned by Uday Hussein, one of Saddam's sons. And he said that he knew there were lions there. It was quite well documented in the years before the war that Uday had these lions. He went to save the animals at the zoo, but he also wanted to work out what else he could do. So he goes to this palace. He's one of the first people in there. You know, the gates are sort of rocking on their hinges. And he said he walked into this enclosure with knee-high grass everywhere. And there was a dog there, a live dog, just sat looking at him. And he thought, well, no one's feeding these lions. They can't be here, or the dog wouldn't be there. And so he starts walking through the enclosure. And he said that in Africa, or I suppose wherever, you recognise a lion in the grass, but just it twitches its ear. And he said, and he saw this distinctive twitch of an ear. And just a few yards from him in this grass, in the middle of Baghdad, in this palace. And thought, oh, there's a lion. And then there was another one, and there were four of these things, two of them which are now moving towards him. And he said that the key when you see a lion is that you stay dead still and you gently back away.
So what did he do?
He ran. He said he just all went out the window. He turned around and he bolted.
What did they do?
I don't know. Well, they didn't get him because clearly they didn't survive to tell the tale.
How many animals did he sort of rescue from this situation? And what did he do with them? And if he couldn't get out, where did he take them?
No, I mean, when he got there, there were only 35 animals surviving. There were hundreds at the zoo originally, but a lot had escaped. Some of the lions had actually escaped and had been rounded up by US soldiers who were a bit alarmed to find wild lions running around when they got to Baghdad. A lot had been eaten. Very hungry people, anything that was plump and tasty had gone. Pretty much what was left was things that had teeth and claws to defend themselves. He basically saved the ones that were at the zoo, of which there are about 35, which involved getting food and water to them and cleaning out the cages. He went around the city trying to find animals that were elsewhere, the lions in Uday's palace. There was a couple of others kind of... There were zoos officially, but I think they were fronts for animal trading organisations, illegal animal traders. He sort of scooped up animals from there. And so this is incredible, sort of went around the city scavenging and saving the various animals in various parts, put them all in the zoo because it was a central place to look after them.
So how is Baghdad Zoo now?
Well, I think it's okay. I mean, he's not been back since he left in 2003. We should say I haven't been. This is all from conversations with Lawrence. But the zoo is at the side of the very famous Al Zahra Park, which is a huge, almost like Central Park for Baghdad. You must have seen on television the giant sort of cross swords, the famous parade ground. That's just right next door to the zoo. So he's not been back, but the Americans basically revigorated the park and the zoo with it as a beacon of hope, I suppose, for the local people. They fixed the irrigation systems and it all became green again. The zoo got 5 million visitors last year. It gets loans of animals from abroad, which is quite important because it helps to maintain standards and improve standards. I think as far as he knows, it's thriving.
Lawrence Anthony, you mentioned he's a conservationist. We've just talked about his work in Baghdad. Give us a pen portrait of who he is and where did he come from?
Well, his ancestors are British, actually. His grandfather was a miner who left Berwick-upon-Tweed in the 1920s to work the gold mines in South Africa. He grew up in sort of colonial days in southern Africa. But he said he went into property, but he always had an interest in conservation. He grew up in the bush and it stayed with him. And about a decade ago, there was a game reserve in Zululand, which is where his family were from, that came up for sale. And he bought it, and in doing so, he turned, I suppose, a hobby into a career.
This chap sounds quite charming. In your sort of few days with him in South Africa, what was he like? What did he charm you?
He's charismatic. I don't think he tried to charm me. I don't think he needed to. I think just the stories.
His actions speak for themselves.
I think so. Yeah, yeah. I think so.
What have you done recently? Exactly. What does he do now? What's his sort of focus?
Well, when he got back from Baghdad, he set up something called the Earth Organization, which is sort of a conservation group that takes a very pragmatic approach. He's very hostile to what he calls bunny huggers. He doesn't do sort of sentimentality with animals. For example, he's not into sort of militant animal rights. He agrees that animals could be tested on for medicine, that kind of stuff. So he set up the Earth Organization. And he also works with elephants. He's got a herd of elephants. He lives on a game reserve. I mean, he's a tourist guy in a way, although the money goes into conservation. And on the reserve, there are some elephants. Now, these elephants, I suppose they're delinquent, or they were delinquent. He's reformed them. They were going to be shot. They broke out. They knocked things down. And he worked with them, and he just calmed them down through nothing other than just hanging out with them. And they got to the point where he described it as it was almost like someone had turned off a light switch. He said one day the aggression was gone. And the lead elephant, Nana, the matriarch of the herd, a giant, giant thing, just approached him. There was a fence between them. The fence would crash, would break very quickly if the elephant charged. Put its trunk through the fence and touched him. And he said, we've got to let them out. He said it was almost like someone had turned off a light and the aggression had gone. And that was a few years ago. So now these elephants sort of wander around on the reserve. They're wild animals. You know, you wouldn't want to approach them. It's like the animals you see on safari, not the animals you see in a zoo or in a carnival or a circus. They're wild animals. They could kill you. They would kill you very easily. They have attacked him and other people at the reserve.
Now, I believe you tried to video him calling out to these elephants. We've got a clip, I think, of him making some elephant sounds.
Come, Nana. I'm calling quietly because I'm trying not to call the bulls that are on the other side who will also come. Come, girl. Come, girl. And now we wait.
Have you trained them to do this, or is this just something that you're able to do?
You can't train. I mean, they're wild elephants. They just know me, and they know that call, and they know it's me, so that they'll come.
Now, David, it must be said that you did video, but the video didn't include the elephants actually coming, or at least you were running away as they did come.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get across just the situation that we were in that. Sorry, we're miles away from anywhere in the African bush. There's a Land Rover, but elephants will go through a Land Rover, you know, with great ease. And we're calling this herd of wild elephants towards us. He'd seen them half a mile or so away, and so he made the call. Which isn't really an elephant noise, it's just him, you know, I think they just recognise his voice. For about 5 or 10 minutes, nothing happened. And then you see the bushes start to rumble and shake, and these elephants appear. And they move quickly for such big animals.
How many of them were there?
The herd is about 12, and I think about 6 or 7 turned up.
Did the large bulls he was worried about stay wherever they were?
No, they didn't. They came.
They turned up too.
They turned up too. Yeah. So we had mothers and babies, possibly the most dangerous combination in the animal kingdom, followed by angry bulls.
And he also does work with humans as well, with Zulus. What, tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, he's very. As I said before, he's very into conservation, and I mean, obviously, he lived through a period of great change in South Africa. Culturally, politically, and his big idea, I suppose, is that the old ways of doing conservation have got to change. He said, you know, 95% of game reserves in Africa are run along old sort of colonial grounds with big fences and big guns.
Keep the people out.
Keep the people out.
Charge tourists to come in. Yeah. Stuff. Yeah.
Now he says, if you don't start involving the local communities, that's just doomed to failure. Because the local communities will come on and poach and kill the animals because, you know, they don't fully understand what's going on. And so what he's trying to do is he's trying to involve Zulu tribes that live in the local area, who all own land or have land that's been passed down through the families. He's trying to get them to pool the land and, rather than farm it, to use it as a game reserve. The land actually borders the very famous Umfolozi game reserve in South Africa, which is where they saved a lot of the southern white rhinos in the early part of the century. So in theory, you could pool all of the Zulu land, and then you could knock down the fence to Umfolozi, and all the animals could come onto their land, and they could charge, the Zulu people could charge tourists and run the kind of game expeditions that you get all across southern Africa.
Well, another bit of stunning audio you recorded there for us. This is one of the Zulu chiefs actually introducing himself.
Before I come on that, I would like to introduce myself.
Yes, of course.
I'm an Inkosi, Piwa Inkosi, Chagide Biela of the late Inkosi Kanyiso Biela Kamkhombisi Kadumezweni Kamkhosana. I'm here as the leader of the Biela clan.
Now, David, who was that chap?
This guy's incredible. I mean, as he said, he's the leader of the Biela clan, which is one of the Zulu tribes. He's very, very supportive of this Royal Zulu game project. He's the leader of one of the 5 tribes who own the land, and he's trying to convince colleagues and people in his tribe that it has benefits to them. But we should also say that he's very famous in a way, because his great-great-grandfather was a very, very important Zulu chief at the Battle of Isandlwana, which, if you've seen the film Zulu, which I'm sure everybody has, that was at a place called Rorke's Drift the day after the Battle of Isandlwana, where the Brits got their butts kicked. The Zulus just completely trounced the British army. It was a huge, embarrassing defeat at the time. And what happened was at the beginning of the battle, though, that the Brits opened up with the cannons, and the Zulus had never fought against people with cannons before, and they panicked, and they all started running away. And this guy's relative, he was a big sort of chief himself at the time, but he stood up and he yelled at everyone. He said, "No one gave you permission to run away. Turn and fight." And they did. But as he said it, he was shot between the eyes and died. But he rallied the cause, and the Zulu army sort of then went on and trounced the Brits.
Okay, David, we'll leave that tale there. Now, if you want to read David's full story about his trip to South Africa, his conversations with Zulu chiefs, and the whole thing with Lawrence Anthony, go to the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/environment. There's also a gallery of great pictures there. You can also find out in there why you had to put a goat on expenses.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. Here's David and James with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Trees across the tropics are getting bigger and offering unexpected help in the fight against climate change, scientists have discovered. A laborious study of the girth of 70,000 trees across Africa has shown that tropical forests are soaking up more carbon dioxide pollution than anyone realised. Almost one-fifth of our fossil fuel emissions are absorbed by forests across Africa, Amazonia and Asia, the research suggests.
The first case in the UK of a person contracting the human form of BSE after being treated with infected blood products was confirmed this week by the Health Protection Agency. The elderly man, who was a haemophiliac, had been treated with blood products that were traced back to a victim of VCJD. He himself had shown no signs of the disease, and the infection was identified during a post-mortem examination.
New research has revealed that meltwater pooling on the Arctic sea ice is causing it to melt at a faster rate than computer models had predicted as recently as 2007. Part of the reasons for the discrepancy has to do with melt ponds, which are pools of melted ice and snow that form on the sea ice when it is warmed in spring and summer. As they are darker than ice and snow, they absorb solar radiation rather than reflect it, which accelerates the melting process.
Men are more likely to think of women as objects if they have looked at sexy pictures of females beforehand, psychologists said this week. Researchers used brain scans to show that when straight men looked at pictures of women in bikinis, areas of the brain that normally light up in anticipation of using tools, like spanners and screwdrivers, were activated. Susan Fisk, a psychologist at Princeton University in New Jersey, said the changes in brain activity suggest sexy images can shift the way men perceive women, turning them from people to interact with to objects to act upon.
James, David, thank you very much. I'm reluctant that to even mention. I'm really reluctant to mention even that last story. So we'll, if Nell was here, she could destroy herself.
But sarcasm in the way David.
Let's move away from that to the first story about the trees. At the risk of making this the David Adam cast, you wrote that story, David, about the carbon emissions being soaked up by extra forest growth. Now it's kind of to be expected that if there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, trees would grow because they need this to grow. Is this something that just shows that climate models and that kind of thing are even more complicated than we thought? You've got to add all these things all the time.
You say it's to be expected, but that does dismiss 40 years of research to prove it.
That's not what I meant. It was a hypothesis,
and I think it's not an easy thing to check with trees. I think what's interesting with this is that it sounds obvious, you know, trees grow, of course they do. You know, we all know that you plant a tree, you soak up carbon, that's a good thing. But if you look at a large patch of forest, what they actually thought was that would be effectively carbon neutral, because some trees would be growing, absorbing carbon, but some would also be dying and giving off their carbon. And actually that's not the case. There's a very, very extensive study of trees across Africa shows that, as you say, they think the extra CO2 in the atmosphere fertilizes extra growth. So the trees effectively get bigger before they die.
What I find astonishing about this story is the extent of the extra growth and what difference that makes. And if I'm understanding it right, we're talking about 5 billion tons of CO2 extra growth that's being soaked up each year, which is roughly 20% of human carbon emissions in the year, roughly, well, just under what the US puts out or what China puts out.
So, it's a lot of trees.
And it's an astonishing amount of carbon. So it's in one sense, it's kind of a good news for us in that, it's a negative feedback. We're always talking about positive feedbacks and tipping points that might send us over the edge or whatever. But this is a negative feedback, which is kind of drawing us away from the brink slightly, perhaps. Is it enough, and is it going to carry on long enough to make a big enough difference?
I think it's good news for now, but it's a subtle point, but it doesn't change what's being observed. So we already knew that the CO2 in the atmosphere was going up by between 2 or 3 parts per million every year, which is really bad news. And the tree effect was already accounted for, if you like, in that calculation. So it's not a new benefit.
Even without that positive, that negative feedback, we're still, you know, it's not soaking up enough.
We basically knew that roughly half of the emissions that we send up into the atmosphere were being soaked up again. Now, about half goes into the sea. We knew it's quite easy to measure. But they weren't quite sure where the other half was going, and they found a big proportion of it is now going into the trees. So it solved that part of the puzzle. And the problem is that it won't go on forever. The trees can't keep on getting bigger. And so at some point, this effect will stop. And
that's going to reach some new carbon balance, aren't we?
Yeah. And it might even then go into reverse. It's what's called a carbon sink at the moment because the CO2 is being absorbed. It might become a source.
So it's not quite a get out of jail free card.
It's not at all get out of jail free card.
All right, well, staying on the subject of climate change, NASA, seeing probably the success of the LHC rap and the Jodrell Bank song, has got a rap of its own on climate change.
The Jodrell Bank one worked.
It worked. You didn't like it very much, but it did work. Do you want to hear it, guys?
Absolutely. Yeah? Yeah? It sounds brilliant.
Let's play a bit of it.
Is this you singing?
See, that's the catch. It's not all that obvious, but changes in the north and south are going to affect all of us. That's why we got...
Now, here's what I think of this. I've decided I'm going to love all these types of songs from now on, just to counter James's obvious negativity about this. But I like that. I think it's good. I think that anything that has NASA stamp of approval, I love. I'm not sure, I didn't know that NASA was getting into music, but I'm glad it has, frankly. James?
It's grown on me, actually, since the first time I listened to it.
It does sound a bit like a radio jingle at first.
It does a bit, doesn't it? I don't know. If it gets the message out there, why not?
David, as our climate change expert, are you going to be taking aim at climate change as it suggests in the song?
I don't think that's as bad as I feared when I read the lyrics on paper. It's a reminder.
You
me
read
actually,
the lyrics on paper. That's good preparation.
It reminded me a little of the Black Eyed Peas did a similar song about climate
change.
That's
right. It actually sounds like a Black Eyed Peas song.
It does sound a little bit like that.
It does, doesn't
it? I don't know. You know, it's not aimed at us, is it? You know, we already know this kind of stuff. So. If it hits new people and they take aim at climate change.
I'll tell you what.
David takes aim at climate change every day.
I'm very, very positive about
this. It's a very big target.
I want our listeners to chime in with their opinions, of course, on our blog. But also, if you've got your own songs, upload them somewhere.
Can you buy that? Is it
probably. iTunes?
Free, I'm sure it's free on the web somewhere. It's on. We've got a blog with a link to it on YouTube, so we'll link on the blog.
I think buying it might be too fast.
When you say it's a big target, it's a surprisingly hard one to hit, though, isn't it? You know what I mean?
I have to say, though, that despite all the wonderfulness and everything, it's these songs don't have a patch on our own Johnny Berliner, who don't know
where
he is.
Johnny, we need to bring him back. Johnny, if you're listening, all is forgiven.
So let's come back. His song's about dark matter. We need more of that sort of stuff. All right, well, you can find out more about that story and others at guardian.co.uk/science and guardian.co.uk/environment.
Science Weekly.
Last week in Chicago was the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, or AAAS. Regular listeners might remember that The Guardian went ass crazy last year, with Science Weekly getting a field trip to Boston to cover the event from Toscanini's ice cream shop. Well, the powers that be clearly decided that we couldn't better the resulting ass cast, so this time science correspondent Ian Sample is on his own in the Windy City. He wasted no time, though, in collaring physicist Paul Davis of Arizona State University. Professor Davis came to Chicago to propose something radical, that if we were to spend as much time looking for alternative forms of life on our own planet as we do staring outwards into the cosmos, we may actually find it. He wants scientists to think small and concentrate on the many microbial forms of life that we as yet know very little about.
Now, I'm talking only about microbial life. I'm not talking about mysterious ideas of shadow beings that we can't see, anything like that. I'm talking about simply that the microbial realm could contain denizens of a second or subsequent genesis. Now, how do we know? Because the first thing is that almost all life on Earth is microbial, and the vast majority of microbes have not been characterized, let alone had their gene sequence. We really don't know what they are. You can't tell by looking, they're just little blobs. You've got to study their innards before you can position them on the tree of life. And so the truth is that microbiologists who have techniques customized to life as we know it are not going to find life as we don't know it because their techniques won't work. So we could be surrounded by little microbes intermingled with regular life, known life, and we would be completely unaware of the fact that these may be an alternative form of life. Now, that's a challenge because, of course, what do we look for? If you don't know precisely what it is, it makes it very hard to pin down. And so I ran a workshop on this a couple of years ago at the Beyond Center in Arizona, and we came up with some strategies for locating weird life or shadow life here on Earth. And one of these would be if shadow life is ecologically separate from known life, because we're used to the fact that regular microbes can inhabit a very wide range of conditions, the so-called extremophiles that can thrive in high temperatures or low temperatures or high acidity, even high radiation. But there are, of course, limits. And if we found that there were microbes living beyond the reach of known life, in a what we would technically call a region of parameter space that was isolated from that of known life, then that would be a great candidate for an alternative form of life. So we might look in deep ocean volcanic vents at temperatures above about 130 centigrade, which seems to be the upper limit for known life. If we found something living, say, at 170 centigrade, that would be a good candidate. We might look for signatures of life by guessing that there are perfectly good organic molecules which are shunned by known life. For example, the people who work on synthetic life are fond of inserting artificial components into known life. And so they've built up an intuition about molecular stuff that seems to be perfectly good for living organisms but is not used by known life. Now, if we found that that was being used somewhere in out there in the in biological environment, then that would be an indicator that there is weird life using some of this other material.
So this would be the idea of genesis in a biological sense being a multiple event, so that it may happen in differently in different regions of a planet. But the organisms that come about from that may still be basically DNA based, is that right?
There's a spectrum of difference. So we could start out by imagining that we've got the same DNA, but a different suite of amino acids, or even the same suite of amino acids, but a different genetic code. And then we can go the whole gamut through to the possibility of organisms that have opposite chirality. So we know that all of the life that we've studied has right-handed sugars and left-handed amino acids, but this could be 50-50. If you start life all over again, it could end up basically using the same biochemical machinery, but with everything reversed. There's a simple way to look for that. You could get a bowl of mirror soup and see if anything grows in it, because known life struggles with molecules of the opposite chirality. That experiment's been done, and organisms were found that actually were okay, but it turns out that these clever little bugs have things called racemases. These are enzymes that can flip the handedness of molecules, and so they can digest things which have the wrong image. So that's a bit of a crude test, but if you combine that with something else, we might find that all around us there are organisms that have got things flipped the other way around. And there'd be no direct competition, of course, between those and known life, because one would live in a left-handed universe and one in a right-handed universe, and so they wouldn't intermingle.
It sounds hugely interesting, but there is no project to go and look for this at the moment.
Well, I'm talking to a lot of people and trying to encourage them, and so there are some people that have thought about it. For example, there's a heavily contaminated lake in California that's full of arsenic, and there are organisms in there that use arsenic. One of the things that commends arsenic is that in addition to its structural and energy storage roles, where it can mimic phosphorus, it also has the possibility of providing what chemists call a redox gradient, which is to say that it's a source of energy that life can use. So it can drive metabolism. And it turns out that in this lake in California, there are organisms that make use of this. They actually derive their energy from reducing arsenate. The best analogy that I can give is that they smoke it but don't inhale it. So the arsenic doesn't get into their innards and gum up the works. It's not the reason arsenic is a poison for you and me is because the body can't really distinguish between it and phosphorus. So these are organisms that deal with the arsenic. They strip the energy out and spit the arsenic back out. So we would like to find those where the arsenic has been ingested and is absolutely part of the internal machinery. And I have to say, this idea of arsenic life is not mine. It's a young colleague of mine, Felisa Wolf-Simon, now at Harvard University. She dreamt up this idea at the workshop that I ran on this alternative life, and I think there's some mileage in it. So that's one thing. We could be looking for arsenic life. The other idea that I had is, well, we don't know where this alternative life might lurk, and it may be it's restricted to pockets in inaccessible environments. But if known life is anything to go by, if there are alternative shadow cells, let's put it that way, then there should be shadow viruses that prey on them. And of course, viruses get everywhere in the environment. The ocean is more or less virus soup. And we could trawl through the ocean looking for viruses, for example, with arsenic in them. That would be a giveaway that there is arsenic life out there somewhere. Or they could be viruses that simply don't have DNA or RNA, but have whatever genetic machinery this alternative life might have.
Do you think they may be among us?
I have a hunch that they're all around us. They could be under our noses or even in our noses. Because, you know, they're not going to be a threat. It's not like these are alien microbes that are going to infect us or take over the planet. They would have been coexisting for billions of years, and they could be all around. And I think it's entirely likely we just scratched the microbial surface at the moment. There could be any number of interesting things out there.
Physicist Paul Davis there, speaking with The Guardian's Ian Sample. You can read all of The Guardian's AAAS coverage at guardian.co.uk/science. That's it for this week on Science Weekly. Thanks to my guests, James Randerson and David Adam. Don't forget to take aim at climate change, and also don't forget to add your voice to the ever-raging debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Jason Phipps and Alok Jha. Thanks for listening. Polar adventurers measure the thickness of the ice and checking the Earth's temperatures. We're like that ice is the Earth.